everyone, and welcome to the Healthy Skeptic Podcast. My name is Danny Roddy, and with me is Chris Kresser, health detective and creator of the healthyskeptic.org, a blog challenging mainstream myths about nutrition and health. Chris, how are you doing, buddy?
Pretty good, Danny. Good talking to you as usual. Let's see, what's new? Just went to the gym this morning, feel pretty good. I was wearing my gluten is bad, bacon is rad t-shirt. Have you seen these? Diane Sanfilippo made them and she sent me one. It's like my favorite t-shirt now.
It's the Balance Bites girl, right?
Yeah, correct? Yeah, exactly. So I wore this to the gym and I definitely got plenty of looks. And then one person came up to me and asked me where they could get one. So, but yeah, otherwise pretty good. We're still house hunting, which as I mentioned, I just hate, but there's not a lot out there too. It's, and of course everything is ridiculously overpriced, but we've been in the same place for a little over 5 years. Got our chicken coop. We're totally settled. But it's time to make the move.
You're in the Berkeley area, correct?
Yeah, we're right on the Berkeley-Oakland border. Literally, like one side of our street is Berkeley and the other is Oakland.
Man, Northern California is the tops. I love it out there.
Yeah, I do. I love it. And I got to say, I'm enjoying these last couple of days of springtime where the sun's out again. And, you know, you can probably relate to this as a Southern California guy. That's where I grew up. I mean, when it starts raining for more than 2 or 3 days, I get seriously upset.
Yeah, no, I agree. In fact, after this podcast, I'm going to lay out on my sidewalk. So.
Sounds good. I mean, I understand that we need rain to make this. This is why the Bay Area is so pretty, right? You know, we get some rain, we get some green trees. But I wish there was some way it could happen and still be sunny most of the time.
Man, we are too spoiled. The rest of the country is going through a snowstorm.
I know. I have patients on the East Coast and they're like, I haven't been outside in about 3 weeks. This is 9 feet of snow outside my door. I'm like trying to imagine what that would be like. But how are you doing?
Doing well. Bearing through school. As we talked about, it's just sobering seeing how... I guess consumed with calories, my nutrition teachers are. I think as long as you get that perfect amount of calories, it doesn't matter what you eat. Like my nutrition teacher was talking about how there are no bad foods, and that as long as you get enough calories, you should be good. And I just have to almost bite my tongue at every second of the class. But
yeah, because that's worked out really well for us so far, isn't it?
Well, I mean, the sad thing is she's a vegetarian and she has osteoporosis and yeah. And she's a calorie counter. And I mean,
we're so tenacious, aren't we, as humans? Like, how do we just hold on to the death? I mean, that's the positive thing about this. You know, like, what if we could channel that determination in a more intelligent direction? That would be amazing.
It's like you kind of put the paleo blinders on, I think, because like getting back into school and seeing how other people think, it's just kind of crazy, you know?
Yeah. Well, so, more power to you, man. I don't think I could do that.
Hopefully I will get through it.
Yeah. So let's do it, huh?
This is an exciting episode.
Hope so.
Okay. So we're going to be talking about the paleo diet versus the Weston A. Price diet versus the GAPS diet.
The showdown
between the three, because there is much confusion and much overlapping between the three of them. So I think you approached me with the idea and I thought it was brilliant, because I always find myself thinking about the exact same thing. So
yeah, there's some selfish interest. I get about 4 or 5 questions about this per day, like by email or blog. So my new standard canned reply is going to be like the link to this podcast.
All right, cool. Let's get into it. All right. So the first one is from Alina Novak. I've been paleo for a few months and I've had great success. Recently, I've been reading about the benefits of including raw dairy in the diet, especially as a source of the hard to get nutrient vitamin K2. There seems to be much conflicting information concerning raw dairy products. Some say the main protein casein boosts insulin-like growth factor 1 or IGF-1, which will induce growth and less as a cancer promoter. Where do you stand on this?
Oh boy, the dairy issue. didn't we? Yeah, you know, we talked about this, I think, last time, or I talked about it with Rob Wolf.
That kind of a duplicate, but that was a great episode. If anybody hasn't checked that out yet.
Yeah, so check that out. I think it's episode 65, maybe. Just did an interview with Rob, and we talked a lot about that. But in short, we're going to talk also more about the difference between A1 and A2 milk in this episode. There's another question. And so I think I'll set that aside for now and just say that... there's a lot of ways to gather scientific evidence. One is to do, observational studies where you look for associations between certain variables and disease. Like you look at a population, you see how much milk are they drinking, and then you look for diseases and you try to find out if there's a correlation between, dairy consumption and disease. Or you can do a clinical research study on isolated nutrients, like just parts of a food like casein or whey or IGF-1. And then you can try to figure out mechanisms by which those nutrients could contribute to problems. And then you can do clinical studies that just use whole foods like milk instead of breaking it down into, the isolated nutrients. There are very few studies with whole foods, and because they can be problematic in several different ways. But it's also unfortunate because we don't eat isolated nutrients. I don't know anybody who eats IGF-1. I know a lot of people who drink milk and eat dairy products. I'm being cheeky, but it's actually an important concept to understand. There's a great paper that I shared on my blog a while back in an article I wrote. It was published in a major peer-reviewed journal. I can't remember the whole title, but it was, basically these researchers were talking about the concept of food synergy, which means that, you can't really understand the benefit or harm caused by a food without understanding just by looking at the isolated nutrients. You have to understand how all those nutrients act together in the way that they're consumed in a food. That's why, taking supplements that are isolated nutrients without knowing what you're doing can be pretty dangerous.
Totally.
A good example of this is T. Colin Campbell. He's the guy who wrote the China study, which has been totally slammed to the curb by people like Denise Minger and Chris Masterjohn. Part of his thesis is that, his main thing is that animal protein causes cancer. And he based this idea on some of his research, which was quite pioneering, at the time, that showed that casein, which is a protein in milk, causes cancer. And it's true that it does in studies that look at just, feeding rats isolated casein. But what he neglected to mention is that whey, which is also found in milk, another protein found in milk, is anti-cancer, has anti-cancer effects. So when you drink milk, it's kind of a, the cancer-promoting effects of casein are balanced out by the anti-cancer effects of whey. And you never drink milk without whey in it. So when you look at actual population studies of people who consume dairy products, you see mostly benefits. There's several studies that have been published that show that full fat dairy reduces heart disease, reduces diabetes, type 2 diabetes. There's a great study out of Harvard recently that showed that women who drink skim and non-fat milk are, like 80% more likely to be infertile than women who drink whole milk. So I don't see a lot of evidence of, too much evidence of harm coming from dairy consumption in these whole population studies. Now, having said that, there is some evidence, and we're going to talk about that when we talk about the difference between A1 and A2 milk. But I think dairy is a really individual issue. I think it can be a really healthy food if it's well tolerated. And that's really the question. Do you tolerate dairy? For people with autoimmune conditions and a leaky gut, digestive problems, I think it's probably not a good idea. for people who have intact intestinal barrier and who are otherwise healthy, I think it's a really healthy food.
Chris, that IGF-1, that's a precursor to growth hormone. Is that something we'd really not want in any way? Isn't the whole point of like fasting to increase growth hormone and other hormones?
Yeah, I mean, this is where it just gets so complex and where I don't trust that we have the understanding of how all of these compounds work in the body to be able to make those kind of determinations. Like milk raises IGF-1 and IGF-1 can be proliferative, you know, with cancer. And so let's take it out. Yeah. So I prefer to really focus more on food. And I do, you know, it is important to consider the isolated nutrients, but we have to put that together with all the other pieces in the puzzle before we come to a conclusion.
Definitely a good point. Okay, let's get to our next question. This one is from Dave White. Is there any surefire way to know if one should not be consuming pasteurized or raw dairy products? What are the symptoms and signs to look out for?
Well, you know, the gold standard, I think, with any question about food intolerance is an elimination provocation protocol. I don't trust the IgG food allergy tests. I think they're bunk. There's not a lot of support for them in the scientific literature at all. And I was talking with Brian Walsh about this. He's a colleague, a really great guy, a really super knowledgeable naturopathic doctor back in Maryland. And he was telling me about a thing that he did, he or maybe one of his colleagues, where he drew his own blood on the same day, just took two different vials of blood, labeled them with phony names, sent them into the same lab, you know, on that same day. And they did a test on each vial and they came back with completely different results. Like one of them was like, you're going to die if you eat peanuts. You know? And the other one was like, don't eat strawberries and broccoli is out, you know, and it's just, it's not a reliable way of determining food intolerances. And most, you know, allergists who are serious and, you know, well, that, you know, at the top of their game, they don't even use those tests. They use the elimination provocation protocol, which basically means you remove the foods in question out of your diet for 30 days, and then you add them back in one at a time. And you only add them every 2 to 3 days because you can have a variety of reactions to food. You can have an immediate hypersensitivity reaction, which is like, you know, a true allergy where you eat a food and your eyes get, you know, swell up, get puffy, and you have like a severe kind of initial reaction. Or you can have a delayed reaction, you know, several hours later where you break out in a rash, or you have a milder symptoms like digestive stuff, or, you know, brain fog or something like that. And you can even have a reaction the following day. So it becomes really difficult to figure out, you know, how and if you're reacting to foods as you reintroduce them, if you're reintroducing them like once a day. Because let's say you reintroduce, you know, milk one day, and then the next day you reintroduce, I don't know, some grain in the morning, and then you feel bad at lunch. How do you know whether you're feeling bad because of what you ate in the morning or what you know, the milk you had the day before? So that's one thing, you know, to take it out for 30 days and then add back in. In terms of the symptoms, that's unfortunately more difficult to answer. I mean, number one, you probably would have the same kind of symptoms you generally have. So like if you have a tendency to break out in skin rashes, then that's what would probably happen. If you have a tendency to get an upset gut, then that's what might happen. So it would be an exacerbation of your typical symptoms, or could be new symptoms you don't normally experience. Like, you know, if you're the gut person, you might have skin rash, or you might get brain fog, or you know, it could really be anything. So it's really difficult to predict. But if you know, paying attention to your body and you know what your kind of normal symptoms are, just look for any exacerbation of those or any new symptoms that don't, you know, that aren't typical for you.
And Dave mentioned pasteurized or raw dairy products. I can guess you probably don't suggest anybody consume pasteurized dairy products.
Yeah. I don't generally, except for yogurt. Fermented pasteurized dairy products are one possible exception because the fermentation, the problem with pasteurized dairy, as you know, we talked about on Rob's show, is that dairy has lactose in it, the sugar lactose, and lactose requires lactase, the enzyme, to break it down. Most people don't produce lactase themselves. Raw milk, you know, milk that just comes straight out of the cow without pasteurization, has lactase in it. And that, you know, of course, is nature's wisdom. It helps us to, it's got what we need to break it down right in there. And it also has beneficial bacteria, probiotics that also aid us in the digestive process. Pasteurization kills not only the lactase, but also the beneficial bacteria. So you're left with kind of what I call a processed food. I think pasteurized milk is a processed food, whereas raw milk is a whole food. However, when you ferment pasteurized milk products and make yogurt or kefir or something like that, you're adding back in these beneficial bacteria. You're not adding the lactase, but the fermentation process itself consumes lactose. That is fermentation. The bacterial organisms in the yogurt are eating the sugar, the lactose, and that's why it gets sour. And the longer you ferment it, the less lactose it will have. So if you ferment yogurt for 24 hours, it will have no lactose left, and it's very sour. So that's one exception. I think pasteurized fermented dairy products, especially if they've been fermented for a while, are safe. But otherwise, I never recommend that anybody drinks just straight up pasteurized milk. Pasteurized cream is also probably fine because it's extremely low in lactose. And same could be said for butter. So those are mostly fat. So you're not dealing with the lactose issue there. It's best to get, you know, organic grass-fed butter and cream if you can, but it's really pasteurized milk that's the big offender.
On a side note, I just recently had the organic pastures raw cream, and I think it was like tasting heaven. It was one of the best things I've ever tasted.
Yeah, it's off the charts. I mean, the raw cream is unbelievable. Too bad it costs like $12 for a little.
Yeah, it was like outrageously priced.
Yeah, you got to really love yourself to be buying that.
Okay.
It's worth it.
It was really good.
There was another thing I wanted to say there, but I forgot. So hopefully it might, you know, it'll come back to me since we're going to be talking about this in the next few questions.
Cool. Okay. Let's go to, that was Dave's. Okay. We're going to go to Ellie Stewart's question.
Okay. It just occurred to me too, that we haven't even started talking about the actual topic of this podcast, but trust me, people, we will.
I mean, we will.
There is a method to this madness. We'll bring it all together in the end. Okay.
Okay. On to Ellie. Can raw dairy be used as a tool to heal the gut? I know Dr. Natasha Campbell uses it in small amounts in her GAPS protocol. Have you had any success with your patients?
There's the topic. It came back to us. So just to, you know, make a distinction, she's using probiotics to heal the gut. And raw fermented dairy is one of the possibilities. So it's not necessarily that raw dairy itself has a gut healing effect. And in fact, it could have the opposite effect for somebody who already has a leaky gut, which is why on the GAPS protocol, the intro phase of the GAPS diet, there is no dairy allowed. Usually, there's some exceptions, but normally the intro protocol is just the meat and vegetable broths, you know, for a period of time until the gut barrier can restore itself. And then dairy is slowly added in over time. And in fact, you know, like raw milk would be the very last thing that would be added back in. The first one that's added is ghee, because it has no milk solids and no lactose, and it's primarily fat. And then, you know, from there, it might be butter, it might be cream or fermented cream, and then it might be, you know, it might be kefir that's been fermented for quite a while, and yogurt that's been fermented for at least 24 hours. So there's a hierarchy or progression with dairy. But yeah, I think that the bacteria and yeast and other probiotic organisms in fermented dairy are really important to healing the gut over the long term. But in the early stages, when the gut is still leaky, dairy can actually be a problem. And it's not just because of lactose, it's because of casein, and actually because of a particular casein called beta casein, which we're going to talk about when we get to the A1 and A2 milk question. So, you know, I wish I could make it a more black or white answer, but it's really individual. It's kind of tricky to figure out, and it just requires a lot of patience and experimentation and time.
Chris, how do the store-bought pre and probiotics compare to like raw fermented dairy? Is it even comparable with the amount of like microorganisms?
No. That's a good question. There's one of these days, Danny, we got to like have a way to put up links that I'd suggest, you know, or talk about, and we'll get there. But there's a website. I can't even remember the link offhand. I'll have to dig it up, but it compares the microorganism content of fermented foods versus typical commercial probiotics. And there really isn't any comparison. The fermented foods generally have a much higher concentration of microorganisms, and they have a much more diverse representation of microorganisms. So whereas you might get like two or three strains in a commercial probiotic that you buy in the store, you know, there might be 10 to 12 strains in kefir of different bacteria and yeast. In terms of prebiotics, it's a little bit different because there's no live organisms. A prebiotic is just an indigestible starch or long chain carbohydrate that we can't break down in our intestine. So it makes it all the way to the colon, where it's selectively stimulates the growth of certain bacterial species like Bifidobacter. And there's a lot of controversy about prebiotics and whether they're beneficial, or there's some. I think most people in the scientific community believe they're beneficial, but there's an increasingly vocal minority that is kind of raising the alarm bells. In my experience, prebiotics can cause a lot of symptoms for people. They can cause gas and bloating and, some pretty uncomfortable digestive symptoms if people take too much at once. But I've seen them actually be extremely helpful in restoring proper gut flora balance, particularly with bifidobacteria. People who have low bifidobacteria taking the prebiotics can really help boost that, because they selectively feed that particular species. And that even taking Bifidobacter as a probiotic doesn't seem to have that effect. So it's something I'm researching, you know, on an ongoing basis. And if I see something that makes me change my mind, I'll let y'all know.
Like you said, we're more bacteria than we are human.
10 times more.
All right, cool. Okay, this next question is from Travis Wright. And this is one I'd love to hear your answer, because grains are a very hot topic. Okay, so Travis writes in and he says, what is your stance on properly prepared grains? Is it a rat's nest best avoided? I know Stefan over at wholehealthsource.blogspot.com frequently consumes grains that he has soaked, which apparently removes anti-nutrients. Where do you stand on this?
Well, sorry about that. That happened last time. Maybe next time I'll remember to turn it off. So I don't think, first of all, I don't think we can say grains here. I mean, there's a lot of different grains that with a lot of different properties and anti-nutrient profiles, and So the procedure for inactivating the anti-nutrients for one grain is different than another. And in some cases, most cases, it's not about totally inactivating them. It's about reducing the anti-nutrients. The best resource on this subject that I've come across is a previous article in the Weston A. Price Journal. Might be available online now. It was written by this guy, Ramil Nagel, N-A-G-E-L. And he goes into excruciating detail on what all of the anti-nutrients are in grains and all the various grains and what is actually required from a food preparation perspective to break them down, and then how much they can actually be broken down by food preparation. And for anyone who's interested in eating grains, I highly recommend reading that article, because you will feel very tired at the end of it when you think about eating grains. I mean, getting back to the sort of the population studies, I think it's difficult to say that all, grain, like that eating properly prepared grains is going to lead to significant health problems in all people, because we just don't see that. There are cultures like the Swiss that I mentioned earlier, for example. Their diet was basically raw dairy and, sourdough bread, like sourdough properly fermented grain. And I know this could get me in lots of trouble in the paleo world, but it's true. You just look at them and they were healthy and they were eating grains and drinking milk. So go figure. But they were eating properly prepared grains, and they were probably definitely were not eating all of the other food toxins that we, most people eat today, and their gut barrier was probably intact because of that. So, yes, it's probably possible to eat properly, prepared grains and be healthy. Now, having said that, when you read that article and figure out what you'll have to do to properly prepare the grains, you may or may not think that it's worth it to do that. I didn't, I feel better. I used to eat the sort of Weston A. Price way, and we'd eat some properly prepared grains, and we had our own, sourdough starter that we would make, sourdough rye bread with. And I can't be bothered anymore. And I feel better even removing those from my diet too, which gets me back to the whole individual thing. It's best to test the stuff yourself. Don't just take my word for it or anybody else's. Like, try eating some, properly prepared fermented grains and see how you feel. And most people, that I work with tend to feel better without them. There are exceptions to that. But the other thing is that gluten is just, we're just seeing so much research about the harmful effects of gluten and fermentation. There's some idea now out there that really long fermentation of gluten can reduce the harm that it causes. And that may be true, but it doesn't, it's still gluten, and it still has, there are still thousands of studies that document the harmful effects of all of the different components of the gliadin complex. So I would definitely suggest that even if people are going to eat fermented and properly prepared grains, we got to come up with a better name for that, because I'm getting tired of saying properly prepared grains. They should still not, avoid, they should still avoid gluten containing grains. The two grains that I think are okay and that I actually eat myself and recommend to my patients, provided they tolerate them, of course, are white rice, which always sends people for a loop, and buckwheat. Now, white rice, of course, a lot of people think brown rice would be the healthier choice, but brown rice still has the bran, and all of the anti-nutrients and the toxins are found in the bran. And in white rice, that's been removed. So what you have left over is just a starch, a long polymer of glucose molecules linked together. And presuming you do not have blood sugar issues, or, you know, you've got decent glucose tolerance and insulin sensitivity, there's no problem with white rice. It's a safe starch, you know, a safe source of glucose. I wouldn't make it, you know, something that you eat at every meal every day, but it seems fine to eat it occasionally. It can be a healthy source of glucose, which is the sugar that, you know, fuels that our cells know how to use and to make use of, contrary to fructose, for example. And then the other one is buckwheat, which is, you know, it's a kind of a gray area, but I always get this wrong, that all grains fall into one category, and I think they're monocots, but biologically, and buckwheat, or botanically, and buckwheat is a dicot. I could have that reversed, but the point is that buckwheat's totally outside of, you know, the family of that contains all the rest of the grains. And so I find that a lot of people are able to tolerate buckwheat, especially if it's soaked and fermented. Stéphane Guillenet has a fantastic recipe for sourdough buckwheat crepes on his website, wholehealthsource.blogspot.com. And those are pretty tasty too. I don't eat buckwheat so much anymore. I sometimes do, but I eat white rice a few times a week. And but that's it for me and grains.
I think the real question is, would you rather have a potato or white rice?
I don't do well with white potatoes. On the other hand, I eat sweet potatoes almost every day. I love sweet potatoes and I do really well with them.
Yams or sweet potatoes?
I eat the whole spectrum. I mean, because there's like the white, you know, the dark, there's the yams, there's the orange sweet potatoes, the orange yams, and then there's the white, and then there's the Japanese. I don't like the Japanese as much because they're too sweet for me.
Really?
But white potatoes, yeah, I don't feel very good when I eat them, so I just don't eat them. And as a substitute, you know, for if I feel like a starch that's not, doesn't have a little bit of sweetness, like the sweet potatoes, I eat yuca. You can make really good yuca fries or taro. I make taro chips that are really great with duck fat or lard. So there's a lot of options. There's also lotus root and plantains, both green plantains and, you know, ripe plantains. Actually, for dinner last night, I had a pork chop. Cajun style pork chop with like chili powder and cumin and coriander cooked in bacon grease, which is the best way to cook a pork chop, by the way. And then I had plantains fried in coconut oil and then some winter greens. It was kind of like a Cuban, you know, South American meal. It was so good.
I had one of those Okinawan potatoes, the really bright purple ones, and I thought it was incredible. But yeah, man, I'm into yams. But that mm-hmm. meal it just described is making me really hungry.
All right, so I know we've got an A1, A2 question somewhere in here.
We do. That's one I was going to get to. So this one's from Tim, Tim Lundin. How do you feel about A1/A2 milk per the book The Devil and the Milk by Keith Woodford? A lot of evidence that A1 milk, most of what is in the U.S., can cause health problems, especially, as you say, when someone has a compromised gut.
It's a great question. And actually, to be honest, it's one that I hadn't looked into in very much depth. I'd heard about the A1, A2 hypothesis a few times, but I hadn't actually taken the time to explore it. So I did some research on it. I actually bought a copy of Woodford's book and I read it, and it was pretty fascinating. This idea is based on a hypothesis that was developed by a couple of guys, Elliot and McLaughlin, in the 1990s. I think they were both out of New Zealand. And the idea is that the protein in the milk of some cows, but not others, causes inflammation, immune dysregulation, and diseases like type 1 diabetes, heart disease, and even things like schizophrenia and autism. And the The protein in question here was the A1 form of beta casein, which is the second most abundant protein in milk. And there are other variants of the beta casein in milk, which are A2 and then B beta casein. So cow's milk casein protein is a chain of 209 amino acids. And the only difference between A1 and A2 milk is at position number 67 in that 209 length chain. And at number 67, there is a proline in A2 milk, but histidine in A1. So the theory is that a bioactive peptide called BCM7 can be released by the digestion of A1 milk, but the proline at number 67 in A2 milk prevents this from happening. Sorry if this is getting too complex here. I know some people's eyes are probably glazing over right now, but it's actually necessary, you know, to understand this difference between A1 and A2. So in the A1 milk, the BCM7 can be released. That's the theory. And that BCM7 has opioid properties and also cytomodulatory properties. It causes oxidative damage. And, you know, opioids have an immunoregulatory effect. They disrupt the immune function, and they can affect brain function too. And then, of course, oxidative damage plays a large role in cardiovascular disease. So this was the basis for the theory that A1 milk contributes to heart disease and type 1 diabetes. And there was some preliminary research, epidemiological between country studies that seemed to support this idea. For example, they noticed that the incidence of type 1 diabetes was correlated with cow's milk intake in certain countries, you know, where they drank primarily A1 milk, but not in other countries where they drank A2 milk. They pointed out that type 1 diabetes is rare in children of the Maasai tribe in Africa. And, you know, this is a tribe with a really high consumption of milk, but it's their Zebu cows, which are A2. And then they looked at other countries like Finland, where there was a high milk consumption, but the milk was from A1 cows, and they saw a significant correlation between type 1 diabetes and milk consumption in those countries. So that was the kind of, that was the idea. And certainly some of that, you know, seems pretty compelling, especially, you know, when you read it in the Woodford book, and it definitely got my interest. But since that book was published, there's been several, and even before that, there's been several critiques of this hypothesis that, you know, A1 milk is the problem and A2 milk is not. The first problem is that between country correlations in epidemiological research are notoriously inconclusive. We have no idea if the people that developed type 1 diabetes in those studies were actually the ones that were drinking milk. And of course, we can't exclude confounding factors. For example, the people in Finland who drink A1 milk and have a high incidence of type 1 diabetes also have a really strong genetic susceptibility to type 1 diabetes. And there's just too many other potential confounding factors between, you know, the lifestyle and diets and, you know, way of life in each country to make these kind of between country correlations reliable. I mean, keep in mind that early studies like this suggested that meat consumption was correlated with cancer and that, you know, cholesterol was correlated with heart disease. So, and human evidence hasn't shown that to be true. So we don't want to make the same mistake here. And then a couple days ago, actually, Matt Lalonde sent me some scathing criticism of the A1, A2 theory in his, you know, about 14 PDF full text studies attached to the email. And, you know, we're actually going to have Matt on the show with Rob. I'll mention that in a little while at the end of the show. He's a very sharp guy. And, you know, after reading through some of that, there's, you know, several other problems. The original research that was done on this issue was performed in vitro, meaning in a petri dish, using a limited set of enzymes that the researchers thought would be involved in the digestion of casein in the gut. Now, the idea is that none of our enzymes can actually break down that BCM7, and then this would allow it to pass into the bloodstream, especially in individuals with a leaky gut. But this is a flawed idea because we don't actually know what all of the enzymes in the gut are or what their actions are. And it turns out that we've learned recently that there's an enzyme in the gut called DPD4, which is really good at cleaving the peptide bonds next to proline and fully breaking down that BCM7 peptide. So there's, you know, Matt pointed out that there's no study, at least that we've been able to find, where they actually found BCM7 in the bloodstream of a human being. And of course, it has to get into the bloodstream to cause oxidative damage and disrupt brain and immune function. So you might wonder, well, how do they even know that it causes these problems? Well, in the studies, chemists synthesize BCM7 in a lab and then inject it directly into the bloodstream of animals or people, or expose it to cells in a Petri dish and see what happens. But of course, that doesn't mean that it gets through the gut into the bloodstream. So that's a huge hole in the theory. And, you know, together with the lack of strong, any kind of causative evidence, it's hard to say that it's, you know, it's hard to prove this to be true. Let's just put it that way. On the other hand, just because there hasn't been a study that detected BCM7 in the bloodstream, that doesn't mean there won't be. And, you know, lack of proof is not proof against. And it's certainly possible that BCM7 could escape digestion and get into the bloodstream in people with leaky gut. And actually, you know, I looked into this a little bit further, and I found a study that showed that in celiacs, they have decreased activity of that DPD4 enzyme in the brush border membrane in the gut, which means that the enzyme that is required to break that BCM7 down isn't working very well in people who are celiac. And we might assume that that's true in people, you know, with gluten intolerance or anyone who's got kind of a screwed up gut or a leaky gut. So this could compromise their ability to break down BCM7. And if they have a leaky gut, which is almost certain with celiac and gluten intolerance, BCM7 could get into the bloodstream. So this might explain all of the anecdotal reports of people who are able to tolerate A2 milk, but not A1 milk. In any event, though, as I've said before, milk is probably not a good choice for anyone who does have a leaky gut, regardless of the protein morphology, you know, whether it's A1 or A2. Fermented milk products like kefir and yogurt, especially when they're homemade and fermented for enough time, that reduces the lactose content and might improve digestibility of casein, regardless of whether it's A1 or A2. And then you have high-fat dairy like cream and butter, which is pretty low in casein anyways. So for example, butter has a ratio of 80 to 1 fat to protein ratio. So there's very little protein compared to fat. I will say, though, that, I mean, this is just an N equals one, you know, one person's experience, actually two, my wife counts two. we recently got our hands on some A2 milk. We're lucky to have a local farmer who has some A2 cows, and he sells it, just directly to people who are interested in it. We bought a share in one of the cows, so we're part owner of an A2 cow now. And I'll tell you what, it's amazing. It's so, you know, we were drinking Clarabelle milk before, which is, I guess it's a combination of A1 and A2, but this milk was like divine. You know, it was, you know, my wife brought it home. She brought home like a half gallon, and and I went into the kitchen and it was already half gone. I was like, are you kidding me? Did you just drink a half gallon of that? She's like, I can't stop. And, you know, she's pregnant, so she's just like that, you know, it just felt like super, super nourishment for her. And the fat content is higher in the A2 milk. So it's really rich and creamy, and yeah, just tastes pretty good. And I don't generally drink milk, but I drank, you know, quite a bit of the A2 milk, and I didn't have any issues at all. So it's kind of interesting. It doesn't prove anything, but it's interesting nonetheless.
And the main producer of raw milk, at least in California, organic pastures, that's A1, correct, Chris?
Yeah. I'm not aware of any main producer that's using A2. I think the only way to get it is to talk to a farmer who's aware of this. And in fact, this farmer told, we talked to him about it, and he told us that he regularly has to send genetic samples, you know, to Europe to be tested to make sure that, I'm not sure how there would be any contamination unless there were like bulls from, you know, A1 herds that were mixing in with the cows. I don't fully understand that, but you know, the point being that like it's kind of a challenge to maintain that, you know, make sure that everything is A2 all the time. So it's not too easy to get. You really have to find someone who's into this and you know, look for local farmers and stuff. I heard in Australia actually there are some commercial brands of milk that are A2, and also in New Zealand, and it's people are kind of more aware of the issue there. So
New Zealand's they're like really up on grass fed meat too. I think it's like illegal to feed your cows like grain.
Yeah.
Or is that Australia?
I think it's New Zealand. Yeah. That'd be a good place to live for food for sure.
Yeah, really. Well, I hope Tim appreciates the most thorough answer to the A1, A2 milk debate ever. Cool. Okay, let's get to our last question, the money question, or kind of the money question.
Yeah, we made him wait like 55 minutes till we got to the episode topic, but what can you do?
Okay, so we're going to talk about the GAPS diet, and I'm gonna give you a couple different questions. First, what is it? How is it different than from paleo and Western Ayn Price Foundation diet? Let's talk about the importance of bone broth, the importance of probiotics on the GAPS diet, and where we food versus capsules. We kind of already talked about that. And then we're going to talk about how long do you need to be on the GAPS diet before you actually see results?
All right.
Kind of a litany of questions.
Yeah. Part two. no, how much time do I have? And then I'll know how much detail I can go in.
I think, we're almost at an hour, I think.
We had a little drop out there somewhere. And
oh yeah. We're probably 15, 20 minutes.
All right. So, the GAPS diet stands for gut and psychology syndrome. And it was created by a doctor named Natasha Campbell McBride. She, I think, is originally Russian or from that part of the world, but she lives in the UK now. And the history of it is that her son, I believe, was born or developed, you know, autism early on in his life. And she, being a physician and a mother, was very concerned about the lack of effective treatments that were available. So she decided to jump in and do her own research. And over time, she started to believe that there was a connection between nutrition and autism. And specifically, she started to understand that there was a connection between leaky gut and autism, which, I mean, this woman was years ahead of her time. She is brilliant. Yeah, because now, if you look in the scientific literature, I'm actually, there's a paper sitting on my desk right in front of me right now. And I'll read you the last sentence of the paper. This was just published. The last sentence of the abstract is, it is suggested that patients with major depressive disorder should be checked for leaky gut by means of the IgM and IgA panel used in the present study, and accordingly should be treated for leaky gut. So, you know, this is a paper that was published in Neuroendocrinology Letters, you know, a peer-reviewed journal. And this is about depression, but there are several papers that now link leaky gut with autism and other mental, you know, mental and behavioral illnesses. So it's real. And she figured it out a long time before, you know, we started to see this stuff in the scientific literature. So she developed a protocol for restoring gut barrier integrity with diet and probiotics, and that's the GAPS diet. And it's very similar to paleo, and similar to Weston A. Price diet, except for that it removes grains entirely, which of course paleo does too, but it goes a step further and it removes all disaccharides and polysaccharides. Now, you know, when you look at carbohydrate eventually it gets broken down into into the monosaccharides like glucose and fructose, which are then absorbed and utilized. Well, glucose is, at least, you know, fructose is shunted to the liver, where the liver tries to get rid of it because it kind of treats it as a toxin. But glucose just passes right through the intestinal barrier, goes into the bloodstream, and it's rapidly taken up by cells. But in order to get, you know, to break down the carbohydrates we eat into those single monosaccharides, there's a digestive process that needs to happen. And the longer the chains are of those sugars, the more difficult they are to break down. And when someone has a compromised gut barrier or has intestinal dysbiosis, which they tend to go hand in hand, they have difficulty breaking down those longer chain sugars, which are the disaccharides and polysaccharides. And then those sugars linger around in the gut, where they provide food for the pathogenic bacteria that feed on them and proliferate and cause further dysbiosis and further leaky gut. So the idea is to remove these disaccharides and polysaccharides so that, you know, you're basically starving the pathogenic gut flora and kind of rebalancing the internal environment and allowing the gut lining to heal. So when I'm saying, you know, polysaccharides, I'm talking about starch, like the safe starches that I'm generally in favor of, like sweet potatoes and yams and taro and all this stuff, but also all grains, including white rice. And then the disaccharides would be things like milk sugar. Now, I mentioned earlier that on the GAPS diet, some dairy products are allowed, but those are the dairy products that don't have lactose in them anymore because they've been fermented, or that are primarily fat, like butter or ghee. So the other thing about the GAPS diet is that it contains large amounts of bone broths. These are, you know, homemade bone broth soups with chicken bones or beef bones or any animal bones, fish bones. And the process, you know, of making these broths they're simmered for a long time, and the collagen and glycine released from the bones in the broth those are used in the composition of our own intestinal and mucosal barriers. So that's really important to eat, you know, bone broth several cups a day, often when you're just starting on the diet, to help restore that intestinal barrier. In fact, the intro phase of the GAPS diet for people who are in really bad shape, like if they're having, you know, fulminant diarrhea and just, you know, really, really severe symptoms, though, actually the first few days will be just broth and meat, not even any vegetables, because the fiber in the vegetables can really irritate a gut lining that's already severely inflamed. And then, you know, over time, vegetables would be added back in, especially peeled vegetables with lower fiber, and the lower fiber vegetables like carrots and winter squash and stuff like that. And then you would start adding fibrous vegetables back in. And over time, you start adding, you know, like roasted and fried meats, start gradually expanding the diet further and further. But even on the full GAPS diet, grains are never permitted. And, raw milk is kind of a gray area because it has lactose, but it does have lactase. So I guess in certain cases, once the gut lining is healed, that would be permitted also. So GAPS is really more of a therapeutic diet for people who are trying to heal their leaky gut. And certainly the paleo diet can do that too, in the sense that it removes most of the things that would be likely to cause a leaky gut in the first place. But for some people, just removing those things isn't enough, and they actually need more support in the form of the bone broths and removing even the starch, the dye and polysaccharides. And then, of course, the probiotics too, to restore the gut flora, which is an important part of healing a leaky gut. In terms of how long to do it, there's just really, it's again, really individual. I've had a patient recently who came to me who was scheduled for surgery to remove his colon. He had Crohn's disease. He was having 12 to 13 watery bowel movements a day. You know, it was blood, mucus, extremely depleted, skinny, you know, really, really sick. And I put him on the intro phase of the GAPS diet, just with the meat and the broth, no vegetables, which is, you know, it's hard. But when you're facing surgery to remove your intestine, you've got a lot of motivation.
Yeah.
And he did this. And within 3 or 4 days, actually, he was down to 3 to 4 bowel movements a day, which he had never gotten down to, even with high doses of prednisone and Asacol and the salicylate drugs that he was taking. He couldn't believe it. You know, it was like a miracle. And of course, his doctors couldn't believe it too. They said, must be a coincidence, or, you know, it's so bizarre. I can't even believe that. But yeah, it just happened. It was, you know, just coincidentally happened when he started eating only meat broth. And he's doing pretty well now. You know, he's not out of the woods yet for sure, and probably never will be, because he's got a very intense version of Crohn's disease. But he now understands how he can control his symptoms and get to a place where he's able to live the life that he wants to live, you know, and instead of walking around with a colostomy bag. So
that's incredible. Yeah. So it sounds like GAPS, for people who are recovering from illness, paleo, kind of, it's a blanket recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
And then Weston A. Price for those who like to experiment.
Weston A. Price for those who really have they really want to keep eating grains, and they really have the time and energy to prepare them properly. And who do well on ferment on dairy products, because that's a big part of the Weston A. Price approach too. Like I said, I give major props to the Weston A. Price Foundation, the work they're doing, Weston A. Price's research. I think you can't really shake a stick at that diet. You know, it's really solid and helpful and benefits a lot of people. It's just that the population of people that I work with is somewhat skewed. You know, they're people that are dealing with a lot of chronic health issues. And I just see better results in my patient population when people remove grains entirely, for, you know, with the exception of white rice and maybe buckwheat. But I also know plenty of really healthy, vibrant, robust people who are following a Weston A. Price approach. So on that spectrum, there's something for everybody.
That's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode. Chris, how can we find more of your work on the internet this week?
Well, there's lots of cool stuff coming up. You know, I'm still working on the 9 steps to perfect health series, getting close to the end. Just published this, I think the 7th step. And I'm actually excited about getting ready to do my first ebook. And I think the ebook's going to be, you know, the 9 steps to perfect health. I'm going to put all that stuff together, all those articles in one place, along with some really cool bonuses, probably including meal plans, recipes, maybe guided stress management, audio programs, stuff like that. And I'm also, by popular request, going to be making the Grow a Healthy Baby seminar on nutrition for fertility, pregnancy, and breastfeeding into some kind of product that can be accessible to people who aren't in the Bay Area, because I've been doing that seminar live around here. But there's a lot of folks around the country and around the world who've asked about how to get that material. So I'm going to make it either like an online membership site type of thing, or a DVD, you know, with a printed manual. I haven't figured that out yet. But it'll be like, you know, 2 to 3 hours of video, a transcript and PDF, a quick start guide, and then also recipes, meal plans, frequently asked questions recorded by me, and a bunch of other stuff like first foods for the baby, and the role of blood sugar regulation during pregnancy, and how to prevent nausea, you know, all that good stuff. And then really, really excited about what's happening with the podcast. Next episode, we're having the venerable Dr. Kurt Harris on, which I can't wait for.
It's going to be amazing.
Yeah, we're really excited about that. We're going to do something a little bit different, you know, like we do normally with our show, where we kind of pick 2 or 3 themes and stick to that instead of just doing a grab bag of questions. So we're going to talk to Kurt. I liked, because since he's a fellow meditator with a long time meditation practice, we're going to talk a little bit about the role of meditation and mindfulness practice in, you know, dealing with the chronic illness and just the things in life that are difficult to face and sometimes difficult to change. I think that's a salient issue in this world that doesn't get talked about a lot. So we're also going to chat with him about his great recent series called, about macronutrients, not a macronutrient, and why, you know, the quality of fats and carbohydrates is far more important than, you know, whether it's a fat or a carbohydrate. And we're going to talk a little bit about orthorexia, which is, I think, an increasingly big issue in the paleo community. And if you don't know what that is, you'll find out. Tune in for sure next time. And then I'll just give you a little teaser of something we're also really excited about, which is, I don't know, we don't have a name for it yet. It could be something like Paleo Geekorama or Nerdapalooza or something. But it's going to be a special two-part roundtable with Rob Wolf, Matt Lalonde, and myself, a few really geeky paleo folks who like to dork out on all the science, the research in this world and talk about it. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to spend the first hour talking about the latest research that we've been seeing in the paleo sphere, or, you know, in the scientific literature that's related to things like gluten intolerance and leaky gut and the brain gut axis connection, leaky gut autoimmune disease connection, all that sort of stuff. And then the second hour, we're going to answer your questions. So make sure, you know, once we'll do a blog post ahead of time, with more detail, and you can leave some questions for any of us there. So that's a lot, I know, but some exciting stuff. So I wanted to let you guys know.
I can't wait. I'm thrilled. Cool, man. You can find me at twitter.com/DannyRoddy and my website, DannyRoddy.com. Keep sending us your questions at thehealthyskeptic.org using the podcast submission link. Guys, thanks for listening. Chris, it's been a good one. Take care, buddy.
It's been a pleasure. You take care too.